Hello, everybody. I'm Tom Dorsey.
I'm Jay Greg Nanny.
And we are going to be interviewing Bo Parrish today. In fact, Bo is the first person that Dorsey Wright has ever had marketing and sales. And we've never done that for 27 years, but now we have the first one there. And Bo lives in Tennessee, been a client of ours for many, many years, and he's out educating and passing the word to professionals in this business, and really as a consultant, helping them with their business and how to use our products and that type of thing. And today is really all about being world-class. And many of you who have listened to me in the podcast and the webcasts, I have interviewed numerous people from Judd Biasotto, who is one of the great world-class weightlifters, to pool players, you know, like John Schmidt. Right. And I interviewed him. And I always find it interesting what it is to become world-class. And there are so many different ways that you do it and so many walks of life that it takes place. And today, you know, we're going to talk to a triathlete. And this is, what's another term for that, triathlete? Or
so the Ironman is the ultimate triathlete.
What killed me the other day is when I looked at that and I said, you have to swim, 2.5 miles? You have to bike right after that, 112 miles. That's like going from here to Maryland.
Right.
Getting on I-95 and going from here to Maryland. And then get off of your bike and run 26 miles. And I said, when you think about that all together, my mind just can't register. Now, you've run marathons before. You've run the 26 miles.
I've done the
Could
26
you hop
miles.
On a bike then and go 112 miles?
I've done the 26 miles and cannot imagine doing having 2/3 left to go. So I ran the marathon. Past couple of years, I've run the marathon, 26.2 miles. And, you know, it was everything I could do to get through that. And that's 1/3 of the Ironman events. And so it's pretty amazing to me when I step back and think about people like Bo that are able to do this and do it at a level that he does it at.
The fitness that you have to be at that level is unbelievable. I used to competitively powerlift, but we trained to move the weight one time only. Not even rep it, one time, lots of weight. You know, and this is like going forever. I'm going to introduce to you Bo. And Bo, I want to start off with a question of how the heck do you get started in doing this? I mean, what makes a person want to do that?
Well, first of all, Tom, Jay, let me thank you for asking me to be on the podcast today. It truly is an honor. And before we get into the nuts and bolts of triathlon, you mentioned the word world class, and I think it's important that we visit that particular term even before we get into the specifics of my story. And I think to become world-class at anything in life, you really have to be a world-class thinker. You must possess goals that are so big that they scare you. You must believe that you can do anything you set your mind to, and at the root of it all is belief. I also think that world-class performers are absolutely famous for concentrating their energy and their efforts on what they want, and also have the ability to block out anything or anyone who threatens that focus. World-class performers create such an intense level of concentration to overcome challenges and achieve goals that it's the last thing they think about before they fall asleep and the first thing that hits them when they wake up. Now, you ask me, how did I get started? Well, I was actually introduced to the sport in the fall of 2006 by a good friend of mine who I'd known for the last 5 years. Now, I had never been interested in swimming, biking, and running as a kid. But for some reason that day, he had just been to a race, and he was describing the experience. I felt like something that is what I needed to try. And so because of that challenge, I entered my first race 2 weeks later, and it's the first time I had ever put swimming, biking, and running together, and I ended up winning that first race. And there goes a saying in the sport of triathlon, once you do one, you'll never go back. And that was the rest of the story. And so to finish that thought, what I've learned over the last 7 years is that my motivation comes from within. I have a dream so big, my desires are so large, and my passion is unquenchable that external motivation, well, it's nice if it comes, but it's not necessary because the internal motivation that I have is impossible to exhaust until my goal is achieved, and that goal is to place in the top percentage of my age group at Kona, which is the World Championships of Ironman. So I think just to wrap my thoughts up here on world class, what makes me different in my particular sport, and I think it can also apply to life, world-class living, is that I possess self-confidence. I am extremely coachable. Tom, Jay, you guys sat with me in July as I transitioned from retail advisor to portfolio consultant, and I think you were kind of scratching your head. It's like, well, he definitely has a lot to learn, but the fact that I have learned so much in the last 4 months and that I know now, today, more than I did yesterday, it makes it that much more attractive. And the fact that I'm not as good as I could possibly be, it gives me a thought that I will get there. And so the coachability, I think, is an absolute essential trait of the world class. I also know why I'm fighting, my purpose. It's bigger than myself. And ultimately, I operate from an abundance as opposed to a deficit. And I also have no problem with change. I have no problem being uncomfortable. As a matter of fact, I tell myself every day, Bo, you need to get comfortable being uncomfortable. And lastly, Tom, Jay, I would say I'm not afraid to suffer. I'm not afraid to fail. As long as failure is not final, it's part of the process. Failure is a necessary step on the way to success. And so my ability to plan, sacrifice, and commit and set my life up accordingly towards reaching these goals, well, I think that's what makes me world class. And I thank you for the opportunity to share.
Well, thank you very much, Bo. I mean, that's very, very interesting. You know, one of the things that I want you to talk about here is describe what it's like to go that distance. I mean, you swim 2.4 miles. That, for most people, is hard enough. Then a 112-mile bike and 26-mile marathon. What does it feel to actually do that? How does it feel?
Well,
and how do you train for that?
Sure. Well, you know, I'll go back to something that I said just to kick off the podcast is it comes in your belief. And so the most important part about Ironman racing is your mindset and getting comfortable with the uncomfortable. The longer the race, the more mental it becomes. Ironman racing is literally 95% mental and 5% physical. Mental toughness is what moves most people from good to great. And so specifically, you have to be relentless in reaching the finish line, in reaching your goal. You must tell yourself, no matter how you are feeling in this particular moment, it will change. When you get punched in the head on the swim and your goggles fly off, you can't panic because you might drown. When you crash within the first 50 miles of the bike, you have to remind yourself that you have plenty of time and anything can happen. And when you start the marathon and your legs feel like bricks, you must dig down and find the strength to move forward. In Ironman racing, guys, you have to anticipate adversity and know how you're going to respond even before it happens, because you cannot choose the outcome of every situation. But what you can choose is the way you feel about it.
You know, Jay, what would it feel like to you starting the marathon? You've run a marathon with legs that feel like bricks. This is first step.
Yeah, that, I mean, it's tough enough to start a marathon fresh, not having done anything before, wake up, get to the start line in the morning, and just having the mental toughness to start the marathon without having to do anything. I couldn't imagine, you know, starting after having done the other two events and my legs feeling like bricks.
As Bo was talking about this, I have my hand on my forehead. You can picture me. I'm sitting here on my elbow and a hand on my forehead thinking, oh, my God.
Well, and Bo, one of the things that, you know, people have asked me in the past in terms of just endurance is, you know, it's one thing to train for it. It's one thing to go out and do all the long runs and the long bikes, but how do you prepare and how do you deal with providing your body nutrition over the course of many, many hours? Because I know in the marathon, I mean, basically it's 4 hours about for me, but like I said, that's one third. So kind of give us an idea of what you have to do in terms of preparation and then, you know, how you lay out that plan throughout the day.
Absolutely. Well, as we all know, most human beings are going to find it a far stretch of the imagination to go a nine-hour period without taking in some type of nutrition. So if you consider the course of a race that can last, in my case, anywhere from 9 hours to 11 hours, nutrition is absolutely crucial. And so in general, when it comes to Ironman racing, and each distance triathlon is a little bit different, but they say the greatest differentiating factor in performance at the Ironman level is nutrition. And so you bring up a great point, Jay, and I think it's a good question to ask. Me personally, obviously in the swim, you do not have the ability to take anything in. So my particular strategy is to eat a big dinner the night before, almost to the point where I'm uncomfortable, and wake up and drink a meal replacement. I choose Boost, and that way I'm not weighed down when I get in the water. So I'm in the water for an hour to an hour and 5 minutes, and as soon as I get out, I set my watch, which beeps every 15 minutes, and every time my watch beeps as I'm on the bike, I reach for my water bottles. And me personally, I elect for liquid nutrition. It works a little bit better for me, and plus the longer you go in the race, the more compromised your body becomes and the more unlikely it will be to actually take in nutrients. It is impossible to catch up with the calorie expenditure. What you have to avoid is becoming completely depleted, because the farther into the race, the less likely it is you're going to be able to take in calories to keep going. So they literally refer to the bike as a moving restaurant, a buffet on wheels. And for me, the buffet comes in my water bottles. And by the time that I start the marathon, normally I'll make the first 13.2 with water and Gatorade that they have at the water stops. And the water stops are positioned strategically throughout the course at every mile, which are often manned by wonderful volunteers that are completely selfless. And I truly believe that a race would be impossible without volunteers. Is that about mile 14 or 15, I start to take in, and believe it or not, this is going to sound crazy, but I start to drink Coke, because Coke provides instant sugar to their bloodstream. It requires no digestion. And the reason I try to wait as long as I can is because once you start taking in Coke, due to the effect that it has on your body, you have to keep drinking Coke, even if it's just a sip. So what I try to do is mile 14 or 15, is at every single water stop, I will grab a cup, squeeze it at the top so I don't have to stop, and sip out of it through a siphon until I get the energy that I need. And guys, by the time it gets to mile 23 or 24, my body's screaming at me, what have you done to the finish line? And so it takes every bit of me to make it that last mile. The last mile is always the hardest of the 140.6 adventure.
So, but what is for you a time-wise, what do you consider your successful or your best time in any of the Ironman races?
Sure. Well, Jay, my first event was in March of 2008 in Lake Taupo, New Zealand, which is about an hour outside of Auckland. And they say the first one is all about the experience, and the most important thing to do is just to post a number.
Mm-hmm.
Well, being that we were halfway across the world, and keep in mind this was also 6 weeks before my wedding, and my fiance was with me. I'm surprised she's still married to me. She's the greatest sign of grace in my life, is that I was extra nervous, not only for the wedding, but also to finish my first full Ironman. And so my first event, I finished in a time of 11 hours and 11 minutes. And since that time, I've done six others in Sherbourne, England, in Arizona, in Louisville, and in Florida twice. And my best performance was 3 weeks ago at Ironman Florida, where my time was 9 hours and 33 minutes.
Wow.
In England, you almost keeled over, didn't you? You were swimming in 55-degree water, and it damn near was the end of you?
It was. It was the toughest moment that I had ever experienced in Ironman racing was the swim in Ironman UK, is what they called it. And at that time, the setting was Sherbourne, England, and it's a remote castle town about 2.5 hours south of London. And so everything that you can picture in your mind about medieval times, this was it. The swim was staged in a moat that ran the circumference of this castle. And it was cold enough. The race was in September, and September is a particularly gray, rainy season in the UK. And the air temperature was about 56, which is nice considering an Ironman. But the water, Tom, the water, Jay, was less than 55 degrees. And just to put things into perspective, the 55 degrees creates a reaction where when you put your face in the water, you almost snap your neck due to the reflex of trying to bring it back out. And I'm cold natured to begin with, so what 2.4 miles in the water normally takes me about an hour and 5 minutes. Well, this particular swim took me an hour and 30 minutes, and by the time that I got out, I was purple, and I was completely disoriented that as soon as I came out of the water, I fell, and the race director actually saw me fell. And he approached me, and he tried to get me to stop. He didn't think I was medically fit to proceed. And I convinced him if I could run to my bike without falling over, that he would let me continue. And he did. And it took me the first 4 hours of the bike to warm up. But I did.
first 4 hours. You have sponsors, Bo. I know Timex is one of them. Who are some of the other sponsors that you have?
Timex is my title sponsor, and through Timex, I've also gained a running sponsorship through Newton Running, which is headquartered in Boulder. Quintana Roo Bicycles, which is the only triathlon-specific bike on the circuit. Blue 70, which is a manufacturer of wetsuits. And Shimano, which is a bike component company. Those are my biggest sponsors.
Gotcha.
So, Bo, the Ironman in England in the water, would you say that's your toughest Ironman that you've ever done?
I don't think so.
No, actually, no. Jay, it wasn't.
He ended up in an ambulance.
Well, so one of my less than glorious moments happened last August in Louisville. And, you know, we talked about nutrition a little bit earlier. Well, here's an example where I failed miserably on my nutrition, because after a 2.4-mile swim and a 112-mile bike. And, guys, we're talking about Kentucky in August, so it was well into the 90-degree temperature range. I started the run course, and within the first 2 miles, I literally blacked out, and I woke up in the back of an ambulance on my way to the hospital. And what I learned from that is I did not execute my nutrition, and it almost cost me my life. So I was very lucky. And as I said before, guys, failure is fine as long as it's not final. That created a desire in me, and it actually took almost a year and a half for me to find an outlet to channel that determination. And ultimately, it was a year and a half until my next race, but Ironman Florida 3 weeks ago was a personal record by almost an hour. And so what I learned paid dividends for me, and I will continue to learn, and I believe I will get faster because of the little things that I experience along the way.
So, Bo, what's the ultimate goal, the dream? What kind of keeps you going in the sport and doing what you're doing?
Well, Jay, as far as triathlon is concerned, the ultimate goal is to place in the top of my age group at the World Championships in Kona. Now, Kona is the full Ironman distance World Championships. Now, I have competed at the Half Ironman World Championships 3 times and have done well there. I've competed in the Olympic Distance National Championships 6 times, but ultimately there's something about Kona that keeps me grinding, that keeps me pushing, and ultimately I cannot stop until I get there.
So explain that for a second, Bo. You mentioned the Half Ironman and the Olympic Distance. Give us an idea of distances of those events.
Sure. So in the sport of triathlon, there are 4 sanctioned distances. And the first, and what most people find their introduction to the sport, is through what's called a sprint distance triathlon. And a sprint distance triathlon is normally between a 400 and a 500-meter swim, between a 12 and a 20-mile bike, and it's normally a 3.2-mile run. The next distance is what's known as the Olympic distance, and the Olympic distance is a 0.9-mile swim, so just under a mile. It's a 25-mile bike, and it's a 6.2-mile run. The half Ironman distance, or what is known in the racing world as the 70.3 distance, 70.3 being exactly half of the 140.6 miles that composes a full Ironman, is a 1.2-mile swim, a 56-mile bike, and then a 13.1-mile run. And then, of course, as we've discussed, the full Ironman distance is a 2.4-mile swim, a 112-mile bike, and then a 26.2-mile run. Those are the 4 distances that make up triathlon.
What do you do, Bo, to train for this?
Well, I was very fortunate from the very beginning, Tom, to have a coach that was an Olympic swimmer and a Kona finisher as well. And when I first came out and I expressed the desire, and one thing that I'm absolutely confident of, desire is not something that can be coached. It must come from within. I had the desire. He gave me the coaching and set forth a very specific schedule. To this day, I still follow. Monday was a long swim, and I say a long swim between a 2.5 and 3.5 mile swim in the pool. Tuesday was a what we call a brick workout, which would be a 25-mile bike followed by a 5-mile run, just to train your legs to go from biking legs to running legs. Wednesday was actually all 3. It was a long swim in the morning, and then a brick workout again, which is a bike followed by a run in the afternoon. Thursday was typically a 2.5 hour plus bike ride. Friday was a short run in the morning and then a longer swim in the afternoon. So I'm swimming 3 times a week because swimming has always been my weakest. They say the best possible strategy is to train your weakness. And I think that makes sense with most things in life. But the weekend was always the quote-unquote fun times. Saturday morning was a 4 to 5 hour bike ride, followed by a 30-minute run. And then Sunday was always a long run and then a swim in the afternoon. So typically, depending on the season, my weekly volume would be anywhere from 14 hours a week up to 24 hours a week.
Is that what you're doing, Jay, for the marathon?
Not quite.
No, like I said, I did one third of the Ironman distance in doing a marathon, and the long runs were good. The 20-mile runs on Saturday mornings were always fun. I always did them with a big group of people. We would meet and go out running, and that was one of the things that I found that helped me a lot was having someone there. Meeting somebody at 5 o'clock in the morning to go running during the week, or meeting with groups on Saturday, that accountability for me was tremendously helpful in just getting to the goal of getting to the marathon and finishing it. And everybody, I'm sure, has different strategies and ways that they go about doing it. Bo, do you use a training partner? Do you train with somebody, or do you do a lot of training on your own?
Well, I have always trained on my own because Ironman is a solo sport.
Sure.
The way that the event is sanctioned is it is actually illegal to ride in packs due to a concept known as drafting,
right,
which is a bike formation that's designed to cut down on the wind drag. And when you are drafting, you actually go much faster with lesser effort. If you guys ever watch the Tour de France, you see a huge pack of riders together in what's known as the peloton. Those guys are moving at speeds between 25 and 35 miles per hour at heart rates that are at aerobic or lower. So more speed with less work is the goal, and that's not something that Ironman racing is set up for. So it's also mentally challenging to train alone. So the training, and what I always think, is a means to an end. I love to race. I don't love to train as much as I do to race. So if I can get through the training solo, then I feel like I'm that much more prepared and at an advantage to race. And guys, you see, I know people in my community that train together, and consistently their finishing times are not as solid as they wish they were. And so that gives me an extra advantage to know that I can complete the training on my own.
What is your resting heart rate?
My resting heart rate is between 42 and 45.
Good Lord.
Wow.
42 and 45. And then, so while you're in this race, what would your heart rate move up to?
My maximum heart rate is 194, and maximum heart rate defined as my heart is about to fall out of my chest.
Right.
So, yeah, they say 90% is about the level where you are upset when people try to talk to you. Okay, I typically train between 75 and 82%. So, Tommy, for a 9.5 hour race in at Ironman Florida 3 weeks ago, my average heart rate was about 162, which is going to put me on the lower side of my what's called anaerobic threshold, which is the point at which your body goes from burning fat as its primary fuel source to carbohydrate. And once carbohydrate becomes the primary fuel source, conversation becomes next to impossible.
I'm stunned. I'm just sitting here stunned.
Yeah. It's crazy to think about.
because I'm in the gym doing cardio probably five times a week. And, of course, I'm a heck of a lot older than you are, too. I don't think you can get your heart rate up as high as somebody in the 30s. Not as old as I am. Now, Bo, what would you tell someone in their 20s? You're 34 years old. You've been through a lot. What would you tell someone who's 26 years old, 25 years old? The millennials who typically are just now beginning to get a little bit of a clue on life.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the questions that I always kind of toss around in my head, and one question that I like to ask of people, of mentors, because I'm a firm believer in seeking advice from those that are simply further down the road of life than you are. And so I, for myself, have established a personal board of directors. I have four men in my life who are between 50 and 70 years old that I meet with on a quarterly basis just for accountability. And one question that I love to ask them, which is why I appreciate the question you just asked of me, is, Tom, what would the 60-year-old version of Tom say to the 25-year-old version based on everything that's happened in your life up to this point?
Oh, my Lord.
And so when you ask me that question, you know, what would I tell a 26-year-old who was not fresh out of college, but chances are had been in a job or two, course, or three or four, depending on how the workforce is going now, is that they're starting to work into their own life, their own skin. They really start to figure out, hey, I've got to make things happen on my own now. I have responsibility for myself, and who knows, that they may have a family at that point. My underlying advice would be to expect the unexpected, to get comfortable with adversity, to live each day as it were your last, and to never waste an opportunity. And what I always like to do then is I would say, hold your hand up in front of your face, get it as close to you possibly can without touching it, and then ask yourself, can I see on the other side of my hand meaning today, can I see on the other side of today? No, I cannot. Because if we could, there'd be no reason for us to have faith. You know, there'd be no reason for us to venture out into the unknown. You know, Tom, you came to a crossroads at some point in your career where you branched all out and you acted on the dream, that which is now Dorsey Wright. Okay, that was scary as heck in the moment. Your hand was right in front of your face, and you didn't know how it was going to turn out. But unless you jerked your hand away from your face and gave it a try, you never would have known. And your comfort zone that had been your career as a retail advisor could have robbed you of the greatness that you have now realized, all because you were too scared to get out of your comfort zone. So the question, the advice is, we were not created to live in a comfort zone.
Bo, you have a quote that you like to, that is very near and dear to your heart. I'm going to end with that. I'm going to let you go through this quote from Teddy Roosevelt, and we'll end the podcast there. This has been really fantastic. I just can't wait to put it up so people can listen to it. Jay, do you have any more questions?
Well, I just say, Bo, I appreciate it. I look forward to it, and I think we'll have to do this again Bo, after you successfully complete your Kona Ironman, whenever that may be.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you, Tom. And as Tom referenced, the quote from Teddy Roosevelt reads, "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles, or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat.
Bo, thank you very much.